This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where this evening I have a very special treat. We're going to return to the issue of Paul McCartney, his apparent death in 1966, and his replacement by an individual to whom we refer to as Fall, F-A-U-L, for False Paul. I have with me this evening Nick Kullerstrom from the UK, with whom I have discussed these issues before. We've done programs on it, and Nick has a new book out entitled The Life and Death of Paul McCartney. We're going to begin with Nick reviewing his book, and then we're going to turn to Anne from Missouri, who has done novel research here on what may have happened to Paul and why he may have been taken out rather than died in an accident. I think you're going to find this quite fascinating. Nick, I'm so pleased that your book is out. Tell us about it.
Hi there, Jim. Yeah. Well, this is quite an old conspiracy theory, really. People say, well, are you sure it's come back again? We heard of that years ago. Well, there's been such a lot of disclosures in recent years. People wanting to get the truth out before they died. People in Apple Corps apparently making these videos. Then there's the memoirs of Billy Shears, which is kind of anonymous, but it's I think it's pretty evident that Sir Paul actually wrote it as his only autobiography. So this brings us back to the great mystery, which none of us can solve, of who the new guy was. Let's start with from the beginning, Jim.
Yeah, have we got the cover of your book up, Nick? I'm not sure. Chance, is the cover up, the first slide?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we've got it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here on the screen, Nick. Yeah. Good. Go for it, Nick. Tell us.
The brilliant young fellow, James Paul McCartney from Liverpool, him and John Lennon got the Beatles together, they were this terrific phenomenon. And for 3 years, the world was held in the grip of Beatlemania that nobody had ever seen before. It was pretty, it's a mania of this British rock band. Well, two British rock bands, really, Rolling Stones and Beatles. Then at the very apogee of their career, after their last American tour in August 66, suddenly they could never perform again. Suddenly they could never sell another ticket.
Never perform in public. You mean never do concerts, public concerts again?
Right. That was it. You know, some lame excuses were given out. Oh, you know, they wanted more studio sound. Well, they did. That was true. This happens to bands. But
remember the claim Nick was given? They couldn't hear themselves play because of the noise of the crowd, as though musicians don't thrive on that adulation.
Yeah. Well, that is the terrific thrill that the bands, the musicians love, of having the sound of the screaming fans and the terrific pounding of the rock music, and that was like the heaven that they were in, those wonderful Beatles songs that we all remember. And then suddenly, what happened when they could not perform anymore? Then we get some months when it all goes quiet in October 66. You don't hear of Paul. He's not suddenly not on the agenda anywhere. Nobody hears about him. And then you start to get traces of a new fellow appearing in November. And it's all quite mysterious, but stuff has been released now. You see the shine new newcomer with a moustache and a much longer face appearing in November of 66.
Well, we can take a look at some of your photos, Nick, as we proceed. I mean, I love the cover. I think it's wonderful. Yeah, tell us about the back of your book. Should I read it? An underground culture has arisen around the Beatles since rumors began to surface that Paul had died, apparently in an automobile accident, and had been replaced. The date, ironically, was 9/11 of 1966. But was it true? In this brilliant book, the leading expert on the London 7/7 subway bombings, who exposed it as a hoax, takes us on an exploration of one of the strangest events in the history of rock and roll. He explains what appears to have happened, how, and why. Nicholas Cullerstrom, PhD, is a distinguished historian of science and may well be the UK's leading iconoclast. He is the author of Terror on the Tube, 3rd edition, 2014, and of Breaking the Spell, 2014. An academician with a social conscience, Nick co-organized the Belgrano Inquiry in 1986, published The Unnecessary War in 1988, and co-edited The Case Against War in 2004. Very fine, Nick. Oh, and a distinguished photograph, may I say, of your countenance.
Huh.
Very spiffy.
Ah, spiffy, yeah. Well, where were we, Jim?
Well, we're about to go to the first photo of Paul, actually, the number three.
Oh, right, okay. Well, here he is, the adorable young boy. And he was, of the four Beatles, he was, as it were, the adorable one. His big brown eyes would drive the fans wild, fluttering his eyelashes. And he came from a family, an Irish Liverpool family of musicians. So he had it, you know, totally in his soul. His father was a kind of jazz, had a jazz band music, and his grandfather, a brass band. So it was totally in his family, making music, playing songs. And Lennon kind of realized that he could never be, as it were, as good as Paul, as a musician. And that's why they had this paradox that all the bands of the time were so-and-so and a backing group, right? But this couldn't be, you know, John Lennon and the Moonbeams or whatever. It had to be the Beatles because there wasn't a lead star. There was an amazing concordance between the four of them. Lennon was the inventor of the band, but he, as it were, he didn't have a kind of leading role.
He wasn't the best musician and composer in the band.
Yeah. So there was amazing togetherness and concordance in the band.
This is a lovely photograph of Paul. I'm really quite struck by it.
Yes. Well, if you look at the film Help, you see colour pictures of Paul, and it's so important to remember what he actually looked like, because all the world is now, we remember the elder fellow, Paul, who came along, and when he came along, he was a bit older than Paul. He stepped in to mend the broken band. He stepped in to replace, to help this catastrophically ruined band, and he agreed to step in and forsake his old identity. It was quite a very extraordinary thing, but he was a bit older.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. I believe, you know, it may well be that the publication of 100 pages, 4 essays on Paul, and I suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either, has contributed to this resurgence of interest, Nick, and of course to the publication of your own book.
Yes, well, I agree. I think it's a wonderful story, and it helps us all to re-experience the actual meaning of the Beatles songs. There was a terrific drama they went through, they were shattered. And you know the way many of us enjoy the later albums more. The original albums had this teenage sort of bliss of Lennon and McCartney singing together, or George and Paul singing together, and you see them together on the stage singing, and that could never happen again once this catastrophe had happened. You never saw them singing together again. They're all four separate individuals, but in some ways, this is the amazing, incredible feature. What they did with albums like Abbey Road was in some ways better.
And the White Album, I love so much of the White Album. About two thirds of it is just wonderful stuff. I mean, some there that are dispensable, but they're just little masterpieces. Like Rocky Raccoon is an almost perfect song, Nick. I have listened to it over and over. Yeah. And it's just delightful and so beautifully constructed, every aspect of it.
Yeah, that's with Fool singing with American accent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you see, Fool, he was called the Man with a Thousand Voices. That's in the Magical Mystery Tour. That's what they call him, the Man with a Thousand Voices, because he's a mercurial, versatile fella. He can do different styles.
And we're actually, of course, talking about Fall, or Sir Paul. In other words, the replacement of Paul James, not the original Paul.
Absolutely, Fall. Right.
And here, let me pull up the next slide, by the way, Nick, just so we can see the man we're talking about on the left.
Yeah, well, we're all familiar with that. And the guy on the right, is that the real Paul McCartney? I rather doubt it. I think there were various doubles hanging around. And Anne can perhaps tell us something about this.
Yeah, I'd be interested in bringing in Anne. Anne, could you tell us your thoughts about this particular photograph? We have to get you unmuted. Yeah, there we go.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh. Actually, Paul in that picture, I'm questioning whether that was a double. I'm not really sure.
You mean this could actually have been Fall and Paul together? But Fall looks too old.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a younger double. I personally believe that Paul had at least two doubles.
Hmm. Really?
Yeah. I'm not really sure. That picture of him always has puzzled me, and I can't really place a date on that picture.
Could this be a Photoshop photograph?
Possibly.
Something about the way the shoulders merge together that doesn't seem real.
Yeah, it's definitely a spoof putting together the old.
Okay, Paul. So this is Fall with Paul, but it's put together by photoshopping.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Well, look at the difference in them. How could anyone look at that and not realize this is not an older, the guy on the left isn't an older version of the guy on the right. They're two different people.
Two different people, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, whoever he was a session musician, a versatile session musician. That is part of the mythos of who he was. Where did he come from? He was used to covering different bands. A session musician has to step in at short notice when a band has been booked or something and a musician is missing or is ill, and quickly take that role. That's who he was before he was asked to step in and become a Beatle.
Do we know where this specific photograph came from, Nick? Do we have any idea?
No.
Anne, do you know of its origin?
I do not, no.
Yeah.
No. I think it was somebody trying to make a comparison of the two.
Yeah. Well, they succeeded.
Yeah, it's just a witty montage showing these two identities.
But it's very good.
It is. It's excellent.
Very good.
Nick, go ahead. Maybe the next photograph, if you want. There we go.
Yeah, okay. Well, this shows, first of all, the picture of Paul. So Paul, on the left, is a bit stretched out.
You mean Paul on the right?
Four is on the right-hand side.
Yes.
And you can see he's got more greenish eyes, a different eye color, okay?
Yeah.
That is actually... the Fool singing Hey Jude. If you want to call up that video, if viewers want to call that video Hey Jude, that is where you'll see this image, and you'll see those quite green eyes, which you also see in the Magical Mystery Tour, which are a strikingly different colour from actual Paul's eyes. Now, Paul is on the left, and I would say that picture is slightly stretched out, okay, which often happens with...
It looks vertically stretched.
Yeah, vertically a bit stretched, which often happens...
Probably done to make his skull look more like this length of the skull of Fall.
Yeah, you get a lot of slightly stretched out pictures of Paul, and it's important to remember the round cherubic face he had. Should we go on to the next picture?
Sure.
Yeah. This small shows the round cherubic face Paul had, and his big chocolate brown eyes. So let's remember that is the real fellow who lived to be just 24 years old. Okay. And then replaced by this, rather more, older chap, who came in the 1966 with a moustache. People say that was to hide various bits of plastic surgery he was having. And he kept the moustache through the spring of 67. Later on in the summer, the great summer of love and peace, it came off. But all the Beatles had moustaches in that period.
Well, which was just joining to cover the fact that Fall needed a moustache, so they all wore them to make it look as though it was their new thing.
Yeah.
And you agree with everything that Nick's been saying so far about the photographs and so forth?
Yes, and if you take a look at Fall's picture, you can notice his front teeth, they're a little slightly different, and he also has a scar on his chin. Right there.
Oh, yeah. On the left, right there on the left, a little nick.
Yeah.
That's very, very interesting. That's a good observation.
Right.
Should we go to the photo of Paul with Jane?
Huh? Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Okay. These two were like rock royalty, these two. Jane was a brilliant star young actor, and Jane Asher. And Paul, when he came to London... He moved into the Asher household. It was a very distinguished household, and her mum was a musician, and taught George Martin, who became the Beatles' manager, so it was quite a powerful liaison, Paul kind of went steady with Jane, as far as a pop musician can go steady. And I think that was a deeply meaningful relationship, and he wrote love songs to her. That is part of the enigma of what happened, because when the new Fall came along, the essential thing was that he would get on with Jane Asher. And Jane kind of quite liked him because he was trying to take over the being of her lost Paul.
Yeah, the Ashers' complicity would be indispensable because they could have blown the whole thing out of the water from the start.
Yeah. And her father was a hypnotist, Richard Asher, a psychiatrist hypnotist, who would have known about the whole thing. The replacement would have advised his daughter that she had to go along with it. So he had a fairly deep role, I think, in the whole thing. And the new guy came along, Fall. And he went along being seen with Jane, but the real love of his life was a year or so after he met the Beatles, Linda Eastman, and him getting together with Linda really coincided with the Beatles breaking up, okay, at the end of 69 and 70, he got together with Linda. And he wants to, as it were, find his own identity after he'd been with the Beatles for some years.
Well, I think you have recounted the wonderful story of when Linda, who had been photographing all these different groups and therefore knew their members very well, came up to Fall and said, "Hi," she said, "I know you're not Paul. When did you join the band?"
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And she said to him, "Look, I want you to marry me and I want to be in your band." And it was one hell of a line, And it was the best thing that could have happened to him, really, because he could talk to her about everything, you know.
Yeah, there was no need to keep up the pretense.
Yeah, she was a savvy New Yorker, and she loved him for who he was. It wasn't that he had to keep slightly rather pretending with Jane Asher. And so Jane was totally smashed to bits by this because she went kind of too far. They were both actors. She accepted an engagement ring from him, which, I mean, in retrospect, she shouldn't have done it at all. And then a month after the breakup, her father was found dead in the basement of their flat. And this was a very, very...
Jane Asher's father was found dead?
Yeah, Richard Asher. And this was obviously some sort of operation because it was first reported in the newspapers that he'd gone out for a walk and got lost and hadn't come back. And the whole family were worried where he'd gone to.
Well, if he was in the basement, he didn't get very far.
Well, that was only reported some days later. Oh, fancy that. He's in the basement of his own flat and they found him
dead. They couldn't find him anywhere.
No, they couldn't find him anywhere.
They looked high and low.
Well, the initial report was that the Asher family were worried where Richard had gone to. And he hadn't come back home again. And was he getting a bit, a bit absent-minded or something? And that was a newspaper item, which I found, actually. With my book, I've gone through very thorough searching of the papers, you see, all digitally searchable papers, so I've been able to get a much...
Did you have to go into the stacks of the microfiche to do that, Nick, or were you able to do it online somehow?
Well, no, I go into the British Library. I did all this research in the newspaper room of the British Library. You access all the music journals and old newspapers, and they're becoming digitally searchable, okay? This is a big change. While my book has a whole lot of authentic detail about that time, that you can go back and search 1960s newspapers now and just put in Richard Asher and see what comes up, you know? And I found this item that he was first reported as having just wandered out of his house. And the family were wondering...
Well, do you think his death could have been because he was going to blow the story?
He was murdered, yeah. Because he was... His daughter was totally shattered to bits. Her life was ruined, really. She was this diva, and the whole story was about her being with a Beatle. The whole story is about the engagement ring, and then...
You're talking about Jane.
Jane, yeah.
That Jane's life was shattered by her father's death, his murder.
Well,
I mean, it must be surprising. I mean, you know, but...
Well, it was two things. She could never grieve for Paul, love of her life. She was never allowed to grieve or talk with anyone about Paul dying.
Right, because he was supposed to have never died, yes.
Yeah. So then she has to be with this new fellow, which she quite liked. She liked the thrill of having a Beatle. But they were basically incompatible. She was a kind of Shakespearean actress with a whole lot of actor guys. She wasn't into smoking dope and everything like Fall did with all his friends and Linda did. So they were kind of incompatible. Her father would have then been angry at the way his daughter had been treated, you see?
Yes.
And he was in danger of talking to people about it. Suddenly, his darling daughter, the big star of the stage, was jilted and left behind and abandoned, and he would have been in danger of talking about it. There are quite a few mystery deaths in this story, Jim, and you do find people just bumped off mysteriously, I think Beatles biographers are at a loss to account for why you get this mystery trail of deaths around the Beatles, but you know you do, and I think we have
to. If you don't understand the death and replacement, how could you begin to appreciate it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so Jane, she's in a state of trauma, buried trauma, and that comes out years later when she starts writing her novels, which are all utterly bleak of despair and trauma, and they're intensely emotional about people having despair and pain, which they don't understand where it comes from, and it can't be healed. And she, so she's got three bestseller books, which are kind of no hope stories of this grief and buried pain.
So they were a form of therapy for her.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. And she's a beautiful woman, immensely successful, but kind of has this inner core of bitter despair, which, people who interview her are at a loss to account for.
But yeah. Of course, that's because they don't understand her history with Paul.
Yeah, yeah, I would say so,
and
yeah.
The death of her father is a consequence and related thereto.
Yeah, so anyway, that wonderful Asher household kind of falls to bits horribly. And the scene moves, if I may so put it, up to Scotland, fall, and Linda then move up to this, for a bit, up to this home in Scotland, a farm, a bleak, empty farm, where Linda's got two kids. And they seem to be quite happy there. Paul starts making albums which don't have anything remotely like the charm of the Beatles sound to them.
Why are we talking about With Wings?
This is before Wings, actually.
He starts
making some albums with Linda called, for example, Ram, and you hear his voice just by itself. And from the point of view of our story, it's important to appreciate this voice you hear of Fall up in Scotland doesn't have anything resembling the charm of the Beatles sound.
Or Paul.
You may be a bit puzzled. Then he starts up with Wings, and they gradually become quite a successful band.
Then, of course, Linda's a part of it.
Yeah, yeah. She can't sing at all, just as John Lennon takes up with Yoko Ono, who can't sing at all. That's quite strange. They both take up with women who want to be in a band and can't sing.
Did Yoko actually want to be in the band somehow? Yoko?
Well, she kept, in a ghastly, horrendous way, she kept being in Apple Studio, didn't she? And she kept hanging around. While they were making the White Album, they had to put up with her being in the studio. And George found this immensely stressful. Well, so did Fall, actually. Nobody liked it at all. And then afterwards, she would make her ghastly noises with Lennon. I mean, people ask me, what proof have you got that Paul died? I think if you want proof, look at what happened to Lennon, okay?
Well, if you want proof, just compare Paul and Fall. It's obviously not the same guy.
Well, I agree. Paul just
got tired of being a Beatle and went to, Tahiti to sip Mai Tais and let somebody else step in for him. I mean, that would be quite an incredible development, wouldn't it? I mean, these are people who are so ignorant, Nick, they don't understand you. We're clearly physically talking about two different people.
It's something you have to see. Once you see that, in a way, it is totally evident.
That's why I felt the chapter on the forensic research of the Italian scientists was so important in the book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That Italian work was rather important. And it was clever of you to get details of that report, which is quite hard to come by.
It convinced me. I mean, thereafter, it was just a matter of sorting out the details of how it had happened and why, but there wasn't any question, but we're talking about two different people.
Yeah, yeah.
Different height, different skulls, different facial features, different palates, different teeth, ears. I mean, you can isolate any one, but when you put them together, it's just ridiculous to think we're talking about the same person.
Yeah, I mean... Towards in late 67, the Summer of Love and Peace, he can appear in public and look like a Beatle, and obviously they're magnificent, they're wonderful. The Fab Four in the Summer of Love and Peace, it was amazing. You get this composite image, if anyone remembers, in Sergeant Pepper, centerpiece of Sergeant Pepper. You see the Fab Four. And you see there a composite image midway between Paul and Fall, which is very cleverly done. And I think that helps to make the transition in people's minds.
Let's go to the next image you have here, Nick, the next line.
Oh, okay. Well, we're all jumping ahead now. This is much later on.
Is this in Norway?
This is in Norway, yeah. And this is quite recently when there was a bit of a scandal because Sapol's voice is becoming rather weak. Although he can put on a good show, he's got a damn good band with him. A whole lot of people at that, in that Norway concert, felt that he wasn't the real thing.
Yeah.
And the stories of Paul is Dead really got going there. And there were articles, which you and I saw, claiming that he was an imposter. And the Norwegian music people should ask, Danish music people should ask for their money back.
Denmark, yeah, okay.
Next year they should put on John Lennon, which is quite funny. So a feeling that this guy who's being pointed, this is, we're looking here at the Sgt. Pepper period. This photo here is the Fab Four with moustaches. That is the Sgt. Pepper image, right? We haven't really talked about the Sgt. Pepper, the supreme masterpiece, Jim.
Yeah, sure. I love it.
Some Beatles fans I've talked to think Abbey Road is the best album, but I think most of us feel that Sgt. Pepper is the incredible psychedelic masterpiece.
Yes, yes, yes.
And had so much to do with that summer, incredible Summer of Love and Peace. And this was apparently composed, it began with Fall and Mal Evans, who was the Beatles' roadie, right? Mal Evans, called Big Mal. Right. And him and Fall started composing that in the autumn of 66. They were on a rather strange visit to Kenya, which is probably a lot to do with a hospital in Nairobi where he could have plastic surgery and not be noticed. That rather mysterious visit to Kenya. So he's with Mal Evans. Mal Evans is close to him and helps him have the courage to become a Beatle. He and Mal start composing, start the idea of Sgt. Pepper. And Mal Evans was going to tell the whole story. He had a book, Living the Beatles Legend. There are letters, both one Anne has found, from John Lennon and George writing to him saying, good luck with the book. Yes, you have our permission. Then he was bumped off about a week before he was due to hand in the manuscript in Los Angeles. We're talking about 76, okay? That is Mal Evans, who suddenly shot dead. And what happens to the manuscript?
What was the pretext? What was this? The explanation that was supposed to account for his death.
He's a kindly gentle fellow, and the story was, he's depressed, depressed loner. And he picked up a gun, and the LA police felt because he picked up a gun, therefore they had to shoot him dead.
He was shot dead by police?
By the Los LA police, yeah, because he was holding a gun. But there couldn't be a more gentle non-violent person than Big Mal, and that story.
And of course, his manuscript disappeared and has never been seen since.
Yeah. Now we're talking about disclosure processes happening. Let's mention the two videos here. There's Rotten Apple. That was a whole sequence of videos which started coming out about 2007, and then the big masterpiece, The Winged Beatle, which came out in 2010. Actually, September the 11th, 2010. It's quite heavy numerology in this story. The Winged Beatle, so that has, as our friend Claire Kuhn has helped put it together, a page of Big Mal's manuscript, Mal Evans' manuscript.
Really?
Yeah. Typed out, and very much in the kind of style you might have expected Mal to write it in, about And it described that page as it's been put together. And you can see it in these various disclosure things I've mentioned, has an account in November of one day of when Fall turns up with Mal Evans at Cavendish Avenue. That is where, Sir Paul, that is Sir Paul's,
introduction. This was his public introduction.
Yeah. Well, not public, but he was taken to meet the Beatles, the band. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, some of them, John would have met him earlier in Paris. That they had a meeting, sometime earlier in Paris. And John was asked the key question, would he agree for the Beatles to continue, right? Because his band, he had to agree. And then his position was, okay, well, go ahead. But he didn't believe that Fall could ever be seen in public.
Really?
That was his initial position. And I'm taking that from Memoirs of Billy Shears. That is the account where we get this account.
Yes.
Which is, I think it's the anonymous autobiography of Sir Paul. John agreed because he's got a lot of recordings of Paul that he wanted to use and put into the music. He agreed to go ahead. There was terrific mandate from the whole national security state of Britain from Howard Wilson downwards. The show had to go on because the immense revenue from the Beatles, the world's best biggest band, just could not stop, right? The show had to go on. So that it had to continue. So John Lennon agreed then, right? Now, on this page we're talking about, it has them meeting up at Cavendish Avenue. The Beatles come, and they meet Fall, and one or two other people there, it's a very kind of mind-blowing experience. Fall has had quite a bit of plastic surgery by then. And they start to realize that he may actually be able to do a Paul, be able to come out and be a Paul, and at that time, the beginnings, they talk about beginnings, John having written Strawberry Fields Forever, and that was a single that came out, and then the ideas for Sgt. Pepper that starts to be mulled over.
Let's go to your last two slides here. You got one to remind us of James Paul.
Yeah.
With what, do you continue to believe that 11 September is the most probable date of his death? We can discuss it with Anne.
Yeah, I think this is a wonderful picture of Paul, and it shows his face in the right proportion, not, you know, stretched out
as you
often get.
Right.
So this is the genius. I call him the England's Orpheus. The great songmaker and inspirer of the world's best band, and we do have this very, very extraordinary story of September the 11th.
And we'll close with the cover of your book again, which I encourage everyone to pursue. It's available on Amazon.com, for example. Nick, that's a wonderful background. And of course, we're going to bring Anne in for the duration for a conversation between the three of us, principally you and Anne, about her research related to Paul's death. But because her slide set takes the full screen, we're going to make a break now and then return. So this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my two special guests today, Nick from the UK, Anne from Missouri. We'll be right back.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer.
Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so he'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center. Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Nick Kohlerstrom from the UK and Ann from Missouri. Nick has been giving us a biographical sketch about the history of Paul and the Beatles and various anomalous aspects of his life. And we're going to pick up with Ann's new research. Nick, perhaps you'd say a few words about how you and Ann became acquainted and began to delve into some deeper, darker aspects of the death of Paul James McCartney.
Well, this is it was a chat group that you set up, wasn't it, Jim? And we were both on it, and I liked the insights that Anne was getting, for example, about this enormously obscure question of did Paul have doubles? I felt she was talking a lot of sense on this. That was it, basically, wasn't it, Anne?
Yeah.
My impression is that the doubles Anne is talking about didn't sing, right? They were there to be seen, but maybe did they? How do we know? On the whole, I've taken there was one supreme musical genius, the real guy who really died. The doubles is a fairly normal thing in showbiz. Having doubles who can step in and be seen when the star is too stressed out or to appear, or he's got a cold or something. Having doubles may be a fairly normal thing in showbiz. Does he sing? You could take the view that the Beatles, such a noise the fans made that their music could hardly be heard. So you could have a double playing there.
Well, Nick, let me pick up with this and say, Anne, you know, please give us your take. You know, come in here any part, because I know you want to review much of the history parallel to what Nick has already covered. But I want to hear your take, because you're making a new contribution here. And it seems to me you have some insights and have heretofore remained in the darkness of the background that may actually make a major difference to understanding what happened.
Okay. You want to talk about the doubles?
No, I want you to just give us your whole, you know, begin in the beginning with the mystery of Paul McCartney as you have it here, and you can bring in the doubles as appropriate.
Oh, well, I started research about 3 years ago, and I was doing other research and other conspiracies. And I'm a big Paul McCartney fan, big Beatle fan. And I went through all the clues on the albums and realized that there was something here that needed to be looked at. So I put the clues aside, and I decided to go to researching the Beatle history and find out what was going on during Beatlemania. And I also realized in doing that, we also lost who James Paul McCartney was. And if we could bring up the first slide.
It's up. The first slide is actually up.
The mystery of Paul McCartney.
Right.
Yeah. If we could go to the next one after that.
There you go.
I would really like to introduce you to the one and only James Paul McCartney.
Is that a flower in his hand?
No, I designed this. And because
you added that. Yeah, his photo was in the center, and then you added the flower on the side. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan.
A token of appreciation.
Yes, for his contribution.
I mean, often men bring women flowers. You are a woman bringing a flower to a man.
Well, why not?
Why not? I agree.
So, first of all, James Paul McCartney, he was known as the Beatle Nut. According to Ringo Starr's, in 1964, Ringo came out with a magazine called Ringo's Photo Album. And it was all Ringo's pictures that he had taken during 63 and 64, and he put it into a magazine for all the fans.
All right.
And you can find a copy online, if you wish, some really great pictures of the Beatles. And he nicknamed Paul the Nut Beetle. He was very jovial. He liked to play practical jokes on people. But he can also take it, too. And he had a great sense of humor, a great wit, as we can often see in his interviews. Very light.
Look at his long fingers there.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Do we know why he didn't go by James? I mean, I'm James Henry Fetzer, but, you know, Henry was my father's name. And I always thought that was appropriate, you know, to honor my father by having my middle name named after my father. But do we know the origin of the James and James Paul and why he went by Paul rather than James?
His father's name was James. So in the family, I guess in order to save some confusion into names, they just call him Paul.
That's probably right.
Yeah. And James is a family name. It's handed down from generation to generation.
Yeah. Let's note here, Anne, the way Paul loved dressing smartly, okay?
Yes.
He was never a scruff. And all four Beatles would turn up with the same gear together, looking absolutely super. And once the replacement arrived, that was all finished, okay? Paul would turn up in trainers and a T-shirt, and Paul had no interest in smart dress at all. And once the replacement happened, the Beatles never wore the same gear again, did they?
That's very, very interesting, Nick.
Yeah. And also, the Fab Four were always interviewed together, more or less always. I looked at all the interviews. Everyone just loved hearing them, all four of them together, having a rap, amazing rap those four of them would have. And after September 66, finish. You know, they were just separate interviews. They never interviewed together again. Stories were dropped down, yeah.
Yes. I think one of the best interviews to see Paul in is that David Frost from 1964.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's delightful, isn't it?
Delightful. That is really, that's Paul. That's really shines in that video.
Yeah. And as you say, he comes up with one-liners, doesn't he? Witty one-liners. That's what we associate with Paul. is a very amazingly lovable character. Whereas when Fool appears, he will warble on for sort of pages about just about anything. And you look at the interviews in International Times, the alternative British news, London newspaper, and he will warble on at great length about philosophy and magic and drugs and the world. You know, totally different from the witty one-liners James Paul McCartney came out with.
Oh, absolutely. And I really believe that James Paul McCartney would never have said anything about drug use because he understood the influence the Beatles had on their fans. And I don't think they would have.
Totally right. Yeah. I mean, James, all of the Beatles took drugs, especially when at Hamburg, but there were drugs to keep them going. They had to perform 8 hours at a stretch and they'd take these amphetamines, you know. But Paul was never a druggie, was he?
No.
Unlike, say, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Right. No, the preludin that they took in Germany was just, you know, to keep them going. And Paul rarely took one. And if he did, it was only one when he absolutely had to stay awake and keep going for those long.
Right, yeah.
And it's also, you need to recognize too, that in Germany was the only time that Paul played piano.
Yeah.
And Paul can play the piano. He could. He just didn't do it in public, but privately he did.
Yeah, they had a quintet then in Germany, didn't they?
Sorry?
They had a quintet, the five in the band. With Paul playing the piano.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and then he had Stu on bass. So Paul, he was raised to be a fine English gentleman with lots of manners, very kind, polite, a generous heart. He's very sympathetic and kind towards other people. He thought of others. I think he was very, he was not selfish at all. He did not have a selfish heart. He also was a very good listener. When he's very attentive when he was people were talking to him, especially in interviews. And I think Paul was a great thinker. I think he had a very active mind, and he was very aware of the events that were going on around him. So he often thought about situations very deeply. Mm-hmm. And he was a wonderful artist. He could draw accurate portraits of people. Yes, he drew a portrait of his first girlfriend, Dot, and I tried to find that on the internet, and unfortunately, I was unable to find it.
Right.
It's beautiful. It really is beautiful. And he drew cartoons.
Dot just disappeared, didn't she? It's a great shame. We love to, we never hear her story, do we?
No, she surely before Beatlemania happened, she moved to Canada.
Yeah, it just vanishes. I mean, the women are silent in this story. There's various women, we'd love to hear their story, and they're just gone, you know. Lucky if they're still alive, you know.
Yes.
Do you think there's a sinister side to that, or just circumstantial?
Well, I think very sinister, the way some of them were bumped off. There was a family in Liverpool that... The Caldwell household, to do with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, that Paul was very close with, and he would love spending time with that family, Dot was be with that household, then they mysteriously, Rory Storm and his mother, Mrs. Caldwell, mysteriously commit suicide in 1972. Now, what's happening there? You know, that is a message to everyone in Liverpool. Just keep quiet. If you know something, keep quiet.
Absolutely.
You know, so there's a terrible silence here with women who we'd like to hear their story.
Yes. Yeah.
Continue, Anne.
So, let's see. So, at the age of six is when Paul started playing the piano. He would listen to his father play, and he'd try to pick out the notes. And what I found interesting, too, about Paul, when he was trying to learn how to play guitar, he had a friend named, I think it was Ian, that taught him how to play. And Paul could take a right-handed guitar, turn it over, And as long as he was strumming his guitar, he could play. So he could play a right-handed guitar without reversing the strings. I don't know very many musicians can do that.
Wow.
But he was really a musician. And at the age of 14 is when he started writing his first lyrics. And his mother had just passed away. And Paul found that writing his lyrics was a way of helping him to heal from the loss of his mother. He found emotional connection there, a way to get his emotions out.
And tell me, Anne, would you agree that him and Lennon both had tragically lost mothers, and the love songs they wrote were basically calling out to their lost mothers? That's what I feel. Marie and Julia. Does that make sense? Do you think that's...
Absolutely. I think he put a lot of thought and emotions into his lyrics. Same with John. I think that was a way of them releasing emotional, therapeutic for them.
Yeah.
And having the two of them as partners, I think, helped bond between them. Does that make sense? They both shared a loss. They understood
each other. Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So Ruth McCartney is Paul's stepsister.
Right.
And she said that John and Paul, that they would just sit down and write once. They would not just sit down and write just one song at a time. They'd have 20 in the works at a time.
Wow. Cool. That sounds great, isn't it?
Yeah. Some would get finished and some would just get abandoned. They were always creating something.
So that's a good quote. Wow.
They were always together. They were always creating songs together.
Yeah. But tell us, Anne, that the lovely Ruth, this step relative, she actually looks quite like Paul, doesn't she?
I thought so too.
Yeah. People think, well, because other relatives don't look the slightest bit. Mike McGeer, supposed to be his brother, does not remotely like Paul, is he? I mean, maybe he must be. He's written books about his family and stuff. But he doesn't look at all like his brother Paul, whereas Ruth does, doesn't she?
That is correct. I don't think he doesn't look much like Paul, but sometimes that just happens in genetics, I guess.
Yeah, right.
I don't. It must be genetics. I believe Mike is his real brother.
Yeah,
well, so they don't really look much alike.
Yeah.
I think Paul probably resembles more of his father. I think.
Right.
Could be. But Paul called himself a true lefty. And I think this is very important that Paul felt this way. He said he did everything backwards. He would write right to left.
Yeah.
And he pedaled his bike backwards.
Yeah, that was a rather odd twist, wasn't it?
Yeah, so he had to teach himself forward thinking, as he called it.
Uh-huh. Well, where did you get this from, Anne?
Well, I was wondering if Paul didn't suffer from some form of dyslexia.
Yeah.
My kind of thinking. I don't think it's because he was just left-handed. I think it's his brain function. That's how his brain worked. It worked backwards.
And also, let's remember, Anne, his name, Ian Iacchimo, that he signed some songs with, like paperback writer. That is supposedly what Paul McCartney sounds like when played backwards, isn't it?
That's what I've heard. Yes.
Yeah, because there's a whole lot of backward, the mystery of backward played messages on the Beatles songs.
Yeah, and finding that before 66 doesn't really surprise me.
Uh-huh.
If he does things backwards, then that's his natural tendency.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't he just kind of explore that and see where it went to?
Yeah.
It's just a thought. He had that. And I've often wondered if he didn't have some form of dyslexia. And in school, he had a hard time with math. He could not add.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a book called The Beatles Book. And it came out in 1964, and this is where I'm getting some of this information from.
Yeah.
And he would say that
this is by the mystery writer Bill Shepherd, isn't it?
it doesn't say who the who it is. It's strange. It's a Lasser special. And I don't see an author, which I think is kind of strange.
Really? The Beatles book?
The Beatles book.
Oh, right.
1964 Lasser special.
Right, okay, yeah.
So, Paul...
I think that same year, there was a book, The True History of the Beatles, by Bill Shepherd.
Yeah, The True Story of the Beatles.
Yeah, I was getting confused, yeah.
So that's where I'm getting some of this information from. And he said that he had a hard enough time adding 2 + 2, much less try to do algebra.
Yeah. So you don't know who that book was written by?
I don't.
Yeah, well, let's just point out, there's some, you know, mystery conspiracy theorists point out that the two books, these two books you mentioned, nobody knows who that Bill Shepherd was. They're conjectures, of course, Neil Aspinall conjectures. But so we've got two books about the Beatles without known authors.
Yeah, The True Story of the Beatles is Billy Shepherd. It was written by Billy Shepherd, but we know that it's got to be an alias for something, someone.
Yeah.
But we also know Billy Shepherd wrote in the Beatles Monthly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I often wondered if it wasn't Neil or somebody.
Yeah, could have been, yeah. But in that case, why wouldn't he have ever claimed credit for it, you know,
right,
when he was asked? Why wouldn't he ever say, well, actually, that was me, you know?
Yeah, that's another mystery. There's a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah.
Looking at their history, too. Also, Paul did not require much sleep. He usually got 5 hours of sleep, and he would find himself going stir crazy. So he had to get out. He had to see the world. You couldn't pin him down very much. He had a very active mind, very, I think it's creative mind. And he would be the first Beatle to tune his guitar and get ready for the concerts. And he liked showers to tub baths, and he disliked shaving. He called it the curse of manhood.
Huh?
So he slept with his eyes open. This is in a Dusty Springfield interview. And
okay.
He quoted, well, you know, I haven't seen myself do it, but actually the fellas say that I do. They sort of see me sleep with my eyes open. I haven't seen myself. I just have half open.
Weird.
Yeah. Yeah. And Paul, he was very generous. When he was over in Hamburg, he bought his brother Mike an expensive camera. So he had a very generous heart. He also bought his father a new home in 1964, allowing his father to retire from the cotton exchange. And he took care of his father financially until his father passed in 76.
Yeah.
And he also bought a racehorse for his father named Drake's Drum. And that he made his father's dream come true because he always wanted to own a racehorse. So to sum up, Paul, I think he was the friendliest Beatle. He was well-liked by everyone. And Ruth Harrison said, I fell in love with Paul the day George brought him home from school. So that's James Paul McCartney that I found. So as we move on to the important events of 1964.
Can we go to the next slide, Ann, or do we stay on this one?
Oh, yeah,
there was the Beatle Nut. That was one we didn't get. You know, you made the reference.
Yeah, that's the Beatle Nut. And the next one, let's see, should be some of Paul's drawings.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. There you go.
Amazing. Where'd you get these from, Anne?
Off the internet.
All right.
Hours and hours of searching.
You got to know what you're looking for. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So that's Paul. He imagined their first album to be named Off the Beatle Track, and I love the play on words there.
Wow. Amazing.
And the next slide should be Paul's drawings. It may be hard to see. It's very hard to see, unfortunately, but I believe Paul would have been a great cartoonist if he hadn't been a Beatle.
Wow.
Yeah. He made those when he was a teenager.
Right.
So the next slide is Everybody's ready. Okay, the events of 1964. So this is where we start, where I started looking into the Beatles. It's important to know that Paul did buy that house in Heswell for his family, for his father. And he, in November of 64, Mr. McCartney marries Angie Williams and adopts a four-year-old daughter, Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Paul accepts Ruth.
He's quite old then, isn't he? We're talking about quite an old man.
Yeah, I think he was probably heading towards 60 by then.
Yeah, right.
Because he had Paul late in life.
Hmm.
So Paul accepted Ruth into the family like a little sister. And Angie states that the day that Paul came to the house to meet them, she stated that Ruth showed him her scars where she had had kidney removed just 5 months earlier. Paul told her that Ringo had appendix scars too, and in no time it was like we had known each other forever. It was a surreal moment in time to watch my four-year-old chatting away with a world-famous person. So there you have a very oriented, family-oriented person just welcoming in his new family members.
Yeah.
And I was looking into some of the FBI reports that started in 64. And I found that in August of 64, the Beatles received death threat. It was a note. And
what was it over, Ann?
This person wanted the Beatles not to play in Denver, Colorado.
And wanted them to not play in Denver?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know. And so they... If they were to play, the guy was going to throw bombs at them. So we have already have death threats.
He was going to bomb them. He was going to throw bombs at them, meaning maybe hand grenades. This is pretty bizarre. If they play in did they go ahead and play in Denver?
Yes, they did. And the FBI said it was extortion because nothing happened.
No.
But the FBI never found a suspect either. But the FBI did keep an eye on the Beatles throughout their touring, of course. They said that they needed to keep an eye on them out of fear for racial rioting that never happened.
Why racial?
Don't know.
I mean, the Beatles have always seemed to me to be totally indifferent to race. I've never grasped any racial aspect to any of it.
That's right. That's right. I don't know. That's what the report said. And I that's what it says. I have to go by that. And also President Johnson, he didn't like the Beatles and he refused their visit to the White House.
Well, Johnson was in many ways a culturally deprived individual. He was impoverished in many ways. He was a brilliant politician, very manipulative, very ambitious and ruthless, but, you know, he just wouldn't have the time. He wouldn't have the intellect or the background or the sophistication to appreciate the Beatles.
That's true.
That's true. Perhaps we move on a bit.
Jack and Jackie would have adored having them.
Yes.
Can you imagine the Beatles at the White House with John and Caroline?
That would have been amazing to see.
Amazing.
Yeah, that would have been really nice. So the next slide, we have the McCartney family. There we go. There's Ruth and Paul. And then the one on your right is Mr. McCartney with Ruth on his shoulders and Angie, his wife.
Well, she was about half his age.
Yes. He was. And that is the house that Paul bought for his father.
It looks like the photo of him holding Ruth is in front of that house, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Very interesting.
So we don't hear much about Ruth. but she ended up having a career in the 80s and early 90s, and she was very popular in Russia.
What did she do?
She was a singer.
Ruth was a singer too?
Yes.
Of course, she and Paul are not genetically related.
No.
Right.
But I think being in the household with a lot of music.
Probably. Sure. Yeah. With a creative spirit like Paul. Yeah. It could be contagious.
Yeah, true. True.
Do you want to go to your next slide? Or?
Sure. That's fine. So in February 1965, the Beatles, they go down to the Bahamas to start filming Help. And Dick Lester, the producer, said that he witnessed Paul refusing heroin. So to me, that shows that he had great self-control. And it's not something that he was interested in doing. And he didn't.
You mean to take heroin once and not become an addict?
Yeah. Not even to start. He didn't need drugs to be creative.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So while he's down in the Bahamas, he brought his father, Angie, and his little sister, Ruth, with him. And Paul and Ruth were seen riding bikes around the island. So there he was being a big brother. And Ruth said that Ted Kennedy was there. He just had a light plane crash. His neck was in a brace, and he would come visit and hang out in the bungalow every night, which is kind of weird. You look back at it now, hanging out with the Beatles and Ted Kennedy. I went around on a bike with Paul. It was fun. It was great fun. We were there about 4 to 5 weeks. So my question is what is Ted Kennedy doing down there? Visiting the Beatles every single night.
He probably actually was addicted to their music. He probably really liked the Beatles, and for him it was a pleasure to hang around with them.
Yeah.
I could see that coming from a Kennedy, whereas you wouldn't get any response at all from a Lyndon Johnson or others of his ilk.
Right. Yes.
The next point you're making about Paul meeting Mark Lane is very, very disturbing, and the one after about John Reilly is profoundly upsetting.
The only comment about the Mark Lane story is that it's more as 50 years later that he tells it. His biography recalls this, and it's quite a rusty memory.
Mark Lane.
Yeah, he claims he heard them composing Eleanor Rigby and that Paul offered to do some music to promote his film. I think that was the essential memory that Paul.
But if in fact Paul were taken out because of that, Mark Lane might very well want to suppress it, not let it be known, because it would reveal a motive.
Yeah.
I mean, that's troubling. I mean, Mark Lane's a very interesting fellow.
Yeah. Well, he seems to have an authentic memory of Paul offering to help him with some music promoting his revelation about the JFK assassination. And this has been, it's been surmised. This is the reason why Paul had to be bumped off, that could not be allowed to happen.
And you want to comment on this, your slide, on these two points that we're talking about?
Well, you have Mark Lane, and he wrote a book debunking the Warren Commission report.
Sure.
And you also have the Beatles, you know, hanging out with Ted Kennedy. So I think that is something researchers need to look into further. They had very strong political views. So I, you know, it's just one of those red flags. You got to take a look at it.
Yeah.
I think that could be one of the reasons Paul knew a lot. All the Beatles did. They were in, you know, they were involved in politics where I don't really think they wanted to be.
What's this thing about this Dr. Reilly lacing George and John's drink with LSD? That is appalling. I mean, who knows how something like acid could affect the creative musicality of talented musicians? I'm That is just irresponsible in the extreme.
This is part of the dangers that they were in. You know, Dr. John Riley was the dentist. They're dentists.
Yeah.
And he invites George and John over to his house for dinner and laces their drink with LSD. And then, you know, John and George, they're sick for 3 days afterwards.
That must have been a terrible experience for them.
Right. And, you know, they didn't know that was going on.
They didn't know what was happening. No.
When did the truth emerge? When did they learn what had happened?
He told them. Dr. Riley told them that you can't go anywhere because I just laced your drink with LSD.
Oh, he told them on the occasion when he did it.
Yeah, and then John and George ran out of the house and jumped into the limousine and drove to John's house. I think it was John's house.
You mean learning he had done that, they felt that was such an irresponsible thing to do without their consent. They didn't even want to be in his presence.
Right. And
they were very alarmed and scared, and they jumped in a car and drove off, which you shouldn't do on LSD, obviously.
Well, but they were chauffeured. They weren't driving the car.
It was a chauffeur, yes.
Chauffeur, yeah.
But I mean, what an insulting thing to do. I would never have anything to do with this man again.
Right.
I think that's incredibly offensive.
Right.
Completely unethical.
Yes. Especially for a doctor. It's really, but these are the things that happened to them. And I believe it was in the anthology when George said that this was happening so often that they would end up taking their own drinks to parties because they didn't want to go on a trip.
They didn't want people spiking their drinks, yes.
Right. So it was very dangerous. So also in October of 65, the Beatles received their Members of the British Empire Awards.
Yeah.
Before John died, he said that it was the worst thing the Beatles ever did.
Was to accept it.
Was to accept that, given how they felt.
Because it made them deferential to the crown, participants in an empire, a whole lot of establishment associations that they really didn't prefer.
Yes. The Beatles, they were for workers' rights, and that's evident in A Hard Day's Night. There's two scenes in A Hard Day's Night when they kind of, you know, were saying, talking about workers' rights.
And coming out of Liverpool.
Right. The working class family. They understood the struggles of the middle class. So John said it was the worst thing they ever did. And then George Harrison in the Playboy magazine, February 1965, he says that royalty is stupid. Yeah, so
he's talking about a hereditary monarchy, really. He's talking about aristocracies.
Right.
Yeah, as opposed to democracies or more constitutional organizations of government, yeah.
So I think this was putting them in a very dangerous place, personally.
Vis-a-vis the establishment.
Yeah.
To have him openly criticizing the crown, at least implicitly.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and I think it's important.
We know what happened to Diana, after all.
Yes. Very sad, very tragic.
But there were additional complications there. Go on. Do you want to go to the next slide?
Yes, that's fine. And it's also important to note that the Beatles only wore their MBE medals on the Sgt. Pepper album. They never wore it afterwards.
Right.
And John returned his award to the Queen in 69 out of protest for the Vietnam War.
Did he now?
Yes. And he also told the Queen he was very upset because Cold Turkey is sliding down the charts.
But Britain wasn't in the Vietnam War. I mean, Harold Wilson kept us out of it, didn't he? Anyway, I'm just looking for the, here are the medals in the, perhaps in the centerpiece of Sgt. Pepper. We can see them wearing their, perhaps that's wearing their MBE medals. Is it?
Pull it back a little, Nick. No, pull it back toward you.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're wearing them there. Okay, we can see it.
Right.
It's a commercial accomplishment. It's mean you brought in a lot of revenue to the crown.
Yes. Yeah. Largest export.
What about the Citizen Lane?
Oh, that's where you find the interview story about Paul McCartney, about him meeting Paul McCartney is in this book.
Hmm.
I just want to bring that to the audience's attention. If they want to go look it up, it's there. Hmm. So next slide, we jump into the events of 66, and we all know John's statement about being bigger than Jesus, and this caused, of course, a lot of rioting in the United States.
Burning a lot of records, ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't retract it, would it?
I think it was good that he didn't retract it. I mean, he explained what he meant on several occasions.
Yes.
It was a function of popularity. They were enormously popular. It didn't mean they were better than Jesus. Bigger doesn't mean better. Bigger doesn't mean morally equivalent or greater. I mean, it was
he also claimed to know that the Christian religion would fade away. And that it might not last longer than rock music. And anyway, he did infuriate people. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I think
they all knew that was the last American tour, didn't they? That they all knew they couldn't do it again.
Well, Brian Epstein already had plans for a 67 tour.
Oh, did he? Oh, right.
Yeah, he was planning it. And in November 9th, 1966 is when he canceled all those contracts for his 67 tour. And he also canceled the UK tour.
Hmm.
Also, everything came to a stop.
Yeah.
What are the Japan Manila incidents, Anne?
Yes. Again, there was just a lot of protesting there. You know, and when the Beatles were in Manila, they were actually shot at the airport.
Really?
Yeah. And
was there any investigation conducted?
Not that I'm aware of, or what Elf talked about. Elf Bricknell, he was a roadie that witnessed them being shot at, and he wouldn't say which one almost got shot that day. So. Just to tell you that 66 was a horrible tour for them.
Mm, yeah, right.
The death threats. And in order to keep the Beatles safe, they were often locked in their hotels and bathrooms and elevator shafts to keep them safe.
Right.
It was very, very dangerous.
Right.
And you have all this chaos going on around you. And it's very dangerous. They also were transported by ambulances and Brinks trucks for their own safety.
Hmm.
And they had just had a lot of death threats.
Hmm.
So we need to, as researchers, you know, look into that kind of chaos that was going on. And that's spring of 66.
Yeah, I think Paul has got a chipped tooth. There's a bit of a story about him having a chipped tooth at this point. Right. I'm not sure if you can see it here. Which he gets in December, in December.
That's Ringo way in the background.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very odd photograph.
It is. So the next slide, please. And of course, that's the 66 protests.
Right.
The albums and such. And John said that the biggest accomplishment that the Beatles made during the 66 tour was escaping Memphis.
Was what?
Escaping Memphis.
Escaping Memphis?
It was bad.
Did they leave a concert in Memphis and they were nearly lynched or something?
Because of the riot and protest is what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just dangerous. So that's something, you know, you need to, as researchers, take a look at that chaos that they went through. So the next slide was September through December. This is a timeline I made out so that people know that September 1st is when the Beatles arrived back to London after their American tour.
Yeah.
And then John leaves around the 4th or 5th for Germany and Spain to do How I Won the War.
Yeah.
And then on the 13th is the Melody Maker Awards. George on the 15th leaves for India for 6 weeks. And also on the 15th, John, Brian, Neil, and I won't call him McCartney because I don't know, you know, exactly which one. They met in Paris for a weekend.
Yeah.
For 4 days.
Yeah.
And then Brian Epstein is hospitalized on the 26th for depression and anxiety.
Right. Okay. Could I perhaps comment on the on this extremely important time sequence Anna just showed us?
Yeah, please.
Please.
Right. Well, I did in-depth research about the Melody Maker Awards on the 13th and all the newspaper reports of this. This is so important. And I would say Paul definitely was not there. Okay. There's a lack of authentic pictures or newspaper reports. And also, there's nothing much to indicate that anything happened. It was supposed to be at the top of the London's new post office tower that this was supposed to happen. There was no indication of any reporters being there or of anyone going there, people like Tom Jones who won their awards. No suggestion that he actually went there. Yeah, and it was a constructed photo op or psyop event that. And I would say it was clearly fabricated, and by that time, Paul was not there. That's the all important thing. And we can also add that Epstein's star party for the night of the 13th, when all the stars were going to have a lovely party, something he loved organising, that also got cancelled without explanation. George, it was not suggested that George was there at the Melody Maker Awards. I would say immediately after that, he had made arrangements to be as far away as possible. And so he leaves for India. So all of them go away. All of them are far away from London when this catastrophe happens. Ringo goes off then to Spain to meet John to sort of console each other. Then there is this, but before John goes to Spain for this film, there is this key meeting in Paris, which I've alluded to, which is described in the Memoirs of Billy Shears, when the new four is taken along to meet John. And that's the reason why Brian and Neil have to be there as well, because normally if John and Paul wanted to have a chat, there'd be absolutely no point in Brian and Neil being with them as well. So the four of them have this big deal that yes, the show will go on. Okay.
Right.
Epstein then is found, as you rightly point out, he's put in hospital, and the Beatle bios say, oh, this is because he had some tiff with his boyfriend. Well, I don't think so, really. We need to appreciate this, process of what happened in October, which is a very silent month, nothing much happens. And Brian Epstein is in hospital being treated. Okay.
Right. The next slide I have is the Melody Makers Award.
Let's just focus. Thank you. This gives us the focus for September 11th as the amazing date. Them not being there at the Melody Maker Awards, and then on the 10th, the paper, a paper comes out, Music Magazine, with an interview that Paul gave. So he gave an interview that week before, a nice, chatty, friendly interview. I think the paper was it Melody Maker? And then on the 13th, he's not there. So that is the historical evidence that frames that date of September the 11th, when it all happened. Okay?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that's Paul or Ringo there.
Well, yeah. It could be a photoshopped picture. I think that's all. And I mean, you don't think those are even the real Paul and the real Ringo?
No, because it's September 13th.
Yeah. But I mean, that could be photos of the real Paul and Ringo, couldn't it?
It doesn't look like Paul and it doesn't look like Ringo to me.
Doesn't look enough like them.
No.
Okay.
To me, it does not look like Ringo.
No, certainly not quite right. And the ear of Ringo in his pictures, the ear is pretty damn weird.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's strange. It looks like a fake to composite photograph any way you cut it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the only photo we have.
Oh, well, come on. There are one or two others where they're holding their awards.
Okay.
We haven't got them here. Anyway, those are the two, Dusty Springfield and Tom, who win the awards. So there's no credible account of them being at some sort of awards party in any newspaper. No credible account of any journalists seeing them at what is supposed to be the Post Office Tower.
Right.
And normally George would be there at a Melody Maker Award, you know. I think previous years George was there. Why wasn't he there? It just has the two of them there, Ringo and Paul. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and we're down to about 20, 25 minutes. So depending on how much.
We'll rush through this then. So we got John's depression getting worse and Epstein canceling the concerts. We also have McCartney and Evans going to Kenya for their trip.
Mm-hmm. But it's already the replacement. This is already not Paul. This is already Paul.
Right. Yes. And there are no recording sessions between June 22nd and November 23rd. So
That's a long period of time.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And they came back on September 1st from their concert. That's understandable why they would have gone then. Mm. And McCartney makes his first public appearance on the 19th. And then I have a slide here showing. Next slide, please.
Hang on. Can we just go back?
Sure.
I had difficulty finding any newspaper accounts of that the 19th, the first public appearance. There are pictures up on the web about this picture, about this image, and Fall is, as it were, kept in the background where the Beatles appear, and Mal Evans is kind of protecting him, rather, in the pictures we see. So there are pictures up on the web. I'm just reporting that I couldn't quite find the newspaper reports of that. And let's just throw in those recording sessions, the recording in November, the beginning of November, they then start off recording, it's Strawberry Fields that they do, isn't it? Okay.
But I mean, we're fairly certain that he's already dead. That he died on 9/11. So all of this, I mean, John being depressed, canceling concert, all this makes great sense if Paul's dead and they're coping and trying to deal with the problem.
Yeah, the catastrophe of what happens to John, this November the 9th is also when he meets Yoko Ono, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So that is, and his wife then starts to feel alienated from him and sees him getting into heroin and starting to become very thin. Him and Yoko Ono.
Which also makes sense if he's had the loss of his closest, dearest friend and colleague. I mean,
yeah, I think it's important, as Anne is pointing out, this is the worst thing that ever happened in John's life, his worst depression, the worst trauma, not really noticed by his biographers.
Right.
Or overlooked.
Overlooked, yeah.
Or suppressed.
Because they can't make sense of it. Because this is a time of great success in their life. Why should he be depressed? You know?
Right. And his chauffeur said on that night that he went to the Indica to meet Yoko, that it took John a half an hour to get out of the limousine. that he was not ready to face the public.
Right.
So here's November. There's Paul in Kenya.
Yeah.
Fall.
I'm sorry. You're right. It's fall in Kenya.
So these are some of the closest to his original look we have, though he's already had some surgery.
Right. Right.
Well, let's point out, Anne, that this picture of him in Kenya only appeared many, many years later, I think the 1980s, taken by Mal Evans. After Mal's death, these pictures somehow become available, right? We're not quite sure how. Whoever he was, this is what he looked like when he was in Kenya, before he became the Beatle. And then on the other picture, I think is a public, one of the first photos when he's trying to look a bit like a Beatle. He doesn't actually. He doesn't yet look like a Beatle, really. I think these early pictures of Paul in 66 are so important because he doesn't yet look like the replacement. He's having surgery. He's got Botox in his cheeks, trying to give him a more round look. But he still doesn't look at all like the old Paul.
Now, some of Van's most important contributions are yet to come, so we want to move forward fairly deliberately.
Okay. Next slide, please. So that's Paul in 64, and that's him in...
Lower left, yeah. And then Fall on the right.
Correct.
Huh. And there's John behind Paul on the left.
Right. So that leaves us with, what happened to Paul.
Right.
Did he die in a car accident?
Yes.
So we already know that Paul had two Aston Martins. He had a blue 64 Aston Martin DB5, and he had a green Aston Martin DB6, a 1966 right. model. Uh-huh. And what we need to focus is on his 1964 Aston Martin, his blue one.
Now, would we agree that all the evidence for this death in a car crash comes from the songs, right? He blew his mind out in a car, Death Cab for Cutie, and they sang songs about it, didn't they? So this urban myth comes out of the Beatles songs.
That is correct. And I took the rumor from 1969 that came out here in the United States, and I decided to find out what are the errors in the rumor and what could be true.
Mm-hmm. Good. Go forward.
So what they came out with in 1969 was there was an argument at the recording studio. Paul left upset in his Aston Martin. It was raining. He picked up Rita. She became hysterical. He lost control of the car, hit a telephone pole.
But hysterical, overjoyed that she was with Paul McCartney.
Yes.
Not hysterical, upset. Hysterical, happy.
Yes.
A distraction.
Right. She distracted her. She distracted him. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And
it's a nice looking car, isn't it?
It is. And so the car turned over. Paul was trapped. The car exploded. Paul was decapitated. His body was burned.
Well, I don't know if he needed to be decapitated, but I take it. You know, the version I've heard that sounded so plausible, he's calling to get out, but the car, the door was cramped. They couldn't get him out, and then it caught fire, and he was burning up, saying, get me out.
Right, and this is what the fans were saying back in 69. So we already know that in February.
This is the first mention of the story. So this is the Beatles Monthly magazine, right? And so... It's officially denying the story, and it's saying, talking about something in January.
But it's way back it's January, so it's
January
months later.
Yeah, so this is an official denial. This is the first indication of rumors flying around.
Correct. And this is their attempt to shut down the rumors. Yeah. So we know rumors are going around.
Go ahead.
So the rumors and the error, of course, is there were no recording sessions during that time. according to service records of the car, it did not catch fire, but it did have an accident, and the steering wheel, the wooden steering wheel, was still intact. What we do know as a fact of the rumor, it did start in September of 66. Tony Burrow, the press officer, received a high volume of calls inquiring about Paul's well-being, and he writes about this in his book, John Paul, George, Ringo, and Me, on page 216.
Right.
Tony Burrow said that apart from a weekend in Paris, Paul spent much of September settling into his new home in Cavendish, St. John's Wood. Around this time, I suddenly found myself taking an alarming number of phone calls from Fleet Street News Desk inquiring about Paul's whereabouts and state of health. Reporters were asking, these rumors we're hearing is that Paul is dead. Can you confirm or deny?
Wow, yeah, that's heavy stuff. Well done, Anne, yeah.
So this is, you know, September. Rumors, large volume of calls, and then in February, they're trying to shut down the rumors.
Yeah.
So,
by the way, Anne, this thing we're looking at here, it talks about his black Mini Cooper safely locked up in the garage.
Yes, that's a 1965 Mini Cooper, and it was given to him by Brian Epstein.
Right. Mini Cooper, right.
Yeah, yeah. So he had three cars.
Yeah, goodness gracious.
Yeah. So, his Austin Martin, his 1966 green. Oh, you want to go to that one? Okay. So with Brian Epstein, I looked into him to see what was going on with Brian.
Yeah.
And I found out that he was laundering money, and there was he was attempting to launder money to down to the Bahamas in 65.
When he laundering money in relation to the Beatles? In other words, using them as the cover?
Using them as a cover to go down to the Bahamas.
But I mean, where is the money coming from that he was laundering to make it look as though it were legit?
Profits that he made from the Beatles. But he was caught. And the British government made him
What kind of scams was he involved in?
Well, that's the only example I found so far of his money.
What was it again?
Money laundering.
No, I know. But where was the source of the money he was laundering?
It was his Beatles profits. He was making off the Beatles. And
it's sort of like skimming you're talking about. Sort of like taking money off of the Beatles for himself.
Probably the whatever they paid him to manage them. I'm not really sure.
He's just trying to evade taxes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was trying to do that.
All right.
Tax invasion.
That's practically American.
He was into gambling also, and he gambled it in local nightclubs owned by the Crays, Ron and Reggie Cray.
Yeah, but these aren't crimes, Anne. I think you're being a bit hard on him. I mean, he did like the sort of seamy side of life, and he did like mingling with rough, tough criminal characters because he didn't have that element in his own character.
And we have about 10 minutes, and I want you to get to the most important part of what you have to say.
Well, right. He's also involved in blackmailing also.
Yeah.
So, and then we look at David Jacobs. Now, the lawyer, he also died of suspicious circumstances.
He
represented the Profumo case, which was a scandal in 1963.
Yeah.
And, of course, he met Epstein in 63.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the gang mobsters, Ron and Reggie Cray, they wanted David Jacobs to represent them in a murder case that they were involved in. And Jacobs refused, and he was found dead. Jacobs was hanging in his garage with his hands tied behind his back, and it was ruled a suicide.
Yeah,
That's pretty difficult to arrange.
Yes, it is.
Hanging yourself when your hands are tied behind your back.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on, Anne. Can we just move on?
Yes. So,
now tell us more about the Crays. Who really were? Yeah, here we go. Go.
Okay, so
was that last photograph of the Cray brothers?
That'd be the next slide. Is the Crays?
Okay, keep going.
So they were twin brothers. They were the London mob. They were connected to the pedophile ring that involved Edward Heath and Lord Boothby, Tom Dryburgh, who was a member of British Parliament, and of course Jimmy Savile. So if you look into that scandal, you'll find a lot about the Crays.
Yeah.
They ran a protection racket for Frank Sinatra and Judy Garland. They had ties to American Mafia, and they also controlled the media and London Metropolitan Police. They had connections with them to cover up stuff. And they also could cover up crimes very well. They can make a crime scene look like a suicide or accident.
And sounds like this was their area of specialization.
Right. And, you know, these guys knew Brian Epstein.
They knew what?
They knew Brian Epstein.
They knew Brian Epstein.
Yeah.
So it just leads you to wonder, you know, with Paul's death, was there foul play? Because.
Well, wait a minute. Now. Are you suggesting that if they knew Brian Epstein, they had some kind of hold on Brian Epstein and they wanted him, for example, to give them money out of the Beatles' vast income? And if Brian was reluctant to do it, they could exercise their power by destroying the Beatles, in particular by killing Paul?
It's a theory. Because Brian did have connections with the Crays, and it's something that needs to be further looked into.
Right, yeah.
Brian, is how far did that relationship go?
But it would just be muscling Brian to get money from the Beatle troffers.
Correct. Right.
And to show him that they how much control they have, they could have killed Paul.
Could be.
Your next slide a picture of the brothers?
Yeah, should be, yes. Yes, that's Ron and Reggie with Judy Garland, and that's Ron Cray with Lord Boothby. So they had connections to Parliament at that time. This scandal ran pretty deep at that time. So
Judy was not looking her best.
No, she wasn't. So, again, I believe that Paul had at least two doubles. I actually believe all the Beatles had doubles. It was a way to protect them, to distract the fans away from them, to get them safely where they needed to go.
Yeah.
So I read this book that was describing these two witnesses.
Yeah.
Paul's double. And Pat Conroy, he was a partner of Brian, said he saw Paul's double, and Joe Armito was a security guard, apparently, at Candlestick Park in 1966, that said he witnessed.
Right. And just remind us what the book was, Anne, that you get this from.
It's called The Beatle Conspiracy.
Right.
And it's available on Amazon. It's a really, I found it interesting, some of the information in there. It really helped me find information about the car.
I'm curious about the idea that it was easy to replace Paul McCartney. I wouldn't think it would be easy at all when you're talking about a musical genius, perhaps the most scrutinized public figure in the world. You know, the idea it would be easy to replace him is tough for me to buy.
Well, what I meant was the public was already used to seeing doubles as him. Now, musically, it would be very difficult. And I don't think it was.
That was my initial reluctance to accept the very idea. How could you have two individuals who look so similar that were both musical geniuses? I mean, you know, that to me was so improbable that I found it very, very difficult until I was convinced by the evidence of the Italian scientists that we really were dealing with two different people. And then, of course, there was no room for argument about it, that he had been replaced, and then the question became the circumstance.
Right.
We've done the eye color and all that, and so let's go to your next slide, given the few minutes we have that remain.
Sure, we'll just run down is the investigation was the car accident in 1964 with his Aston Martin. There was a recess in the fender, foot deep by a foot wide. The windshield was replaced in 66, and the wooden steering wheel was intact. And there's no mention of this in any Beetle biographies, so it's a piece of history that's lost. And we don't know where the...
Sorry, what is the source for what you're saying about the car?
The Beetle conspiracy.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Available on Amazon. I don't want to take away from your book, though, Nick.
What's the story here about cover-up theory number one, theory number two, closing? Okay, this is your final slide?
Yeah, this is my final slide.
Okay.
So we don't know where it was. We know there was damage to the car. It probably happened at night because Paul was known to be up at, late at night. We have evidence that it was raining on September 11th.
Yeah.
So what happened to Paul, you know, is there a motivation for murder, which I encourage researchers to look into. You know, was it a hate crime because of all that happened? Was it, you know, a revenge on Brian somehow and his activities?
What do you think? What's your gut feeling without committing you to it? What's your gut feeling? Meaning that other evidence could cause you to change your mind, but what's your gut feeling?
My gut feeling, I strongly feel that if it was just a car accident, they would have been honest with their fans. It would have been an unfortunate thing. So you have to, I look at, well, why did they cover it up? And it had to be something.
You don't think it was concerned that something hundreds of girls who were in love with Paul would commit suicide?
No, I think they were afraid of some...
They were worried that the band would fall apart. They wouldn't have they'd lose all their income. The British Empire would be have lost revenue.
That's part of it. But you also have to, if it's not a car accident and was foul play, then there would be an investigation and some really bad stuff would have came out about Brian. That's my concern.
Nick, give us your reflections on everything you've heard from Anne. You've had many exchanges with her.
I think that this is really good research Anne's done and very careful. And I think she's got developing a good new angle on it. It sounds like something's going to come of her work. And I look forward to it. Yeah.
So that would mean that there was an accident. We're fairly convinced of that, right? But whether Paul was killed in the accident or the accident was staged to make it look as though he'd been killed in the accident or whatever, that's all up in the air.
Right. It's something that researchers can look into.
But the car did not catch fire.
No. No. The car was actually sold in 2002 Walter R. Ronnie.
Must have gone for a pretty penny.
Yeah, like $400,000. But he totally restored the car. And he told the author of that book, The Beetle Conspiracy, that service records show that that car was in an accident in 66.
Right.
But well, it wasn't
bad. The memoir shares, it has the urgent necessity of mending, getting the car mended and getting it look as if it was all fine. I think he took it somewhere abroad, so there wouldn't be a record of who did this. But
they actually took the car out of the country to fix it.
Yeah,
I think that's what it suggests.
Billy Shears, the memoirs of Billy Shears.
So that same car has to be restored with the same number plate.
And that memoir of Billy Shears goes on and on and on, doesn't it, Nick? Very similar to the loquaciousness you're attributing to Paul as opposed to Paul. This is not memoirs made up of one-liners. This is somebody who loves the discourse at great length and in great detail.
Yeah, 66 chapters, 66 pages, published on 9909.
Someone who cares about numerology.
Numerology as well, yeah. And it's an extraordinarily vivid recreation of that era and what it was like to be in the Beatle band without divulging where he came from.
And would you like to add any final reflections here in the moment that remains?
Well, on the doubles, I just wanted to let people know that in the book, the Beatles book in 1964, Paul did say that when he was a young child, he had rheumatic fever. And that can result into lifelong health issues. And that's another reason why I think Paul had to have a double.
For occasions when he might have been in poor health. And I can't thank you enough for coming on. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest this evening, Nick Kohlerstrom from the UK and from Missouri, for being here, and all of you for listening.